Another form of prayer, if I may move straight on to it, is what we would more commonly perhaps call meditation, and is generally a longer prayer, and each one will do it for whatever length you've got or however often your life allows it, is when we go back, it's a meditation, so you're reflecting with your mind, but also with your imagination, on some aspect of the faith, something that's touching you at the moment. I remember meditating for a year? It probably was on the Trinity. And I went for, every day, months on it, going back 30, 40 years ago. But that's what was nourishing me. You don't have to keep moving and changing subjects. Stay with it. If you've got a nice little baby, well, keep nursing it till it's old enough to walk. Don't have to get a new baby every day. So you stay with whatever's nourishing you. So I'm going to read you now, and my suggestion is we'll do this as a practice. I'm going to actually read a passage from the scripture. I'm going to suggest to you that you close your eyes, and I'm going to guide you through a meditation. It's actually written in your notes for you later, should you want to go back to it. And just let's see, if you find this a way of praying, then I'm just modelling for you from a text, the origin of which I've forgotten, but I've just worked on it a bit myself, on this scene. I'll read the gospel passage, you close your eyes, and I'll take you into it, and at the end of it you'll know whether it actually worked for you, and you can do it with any passage of the gospels. The passage I've chosen is from chapter 5 of John. After this, there was a festival of the Jews, and Jesus went to Jerusalem. Now in Jerusalem, by the Sheep Gate, there was a pool called in Hebrew Bethzatha, which had 5 porticos. In these lay many individuals, blind, lame, and paralyzed. A man was there who'd been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he'd been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered, "Sir, I've no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred, and while I'm making my way, someone else steps down ahead of me." Jesus said to him, "Stand up, take your mat, and walk." At once the man was made well. He took up his mat and began to walk. That's the passage I'm about to take you through a meditation. It's important that you be comfortable now, so if you want to lie on the floor, if that's better for you, do that. If you want to stand, do that. If you're comfortable as you are, do. Just take a minute to make yourself physically as comfortable as you wish. Be you at home. Do what you like. So now quieten yourself in preparation for this contemplation. Imagine the pool. It's got 5 covered ways. Imagine the surroundings. What kind of place is it? Notice the architecture. And the weather. Now let the whole scene come to life. See the people near the pool. How many people are there? What sort of people? How are they dressed? What are they doing? What kind of illness are they suffering from? Are they saying anything? Now you're there, so what are you doing there? Why have you come to this place? What are your feelings as you survey the scene and watch these people? What are you doing? Are you speaking to anyone? Now notice the sick man of whom the gospel speaks. Where in the crowd is he? How is he dressed? Is there anyone with him? Walk up to him, speak with him. What are you saying? And his reply? What sort of an impression is he making on you? What are your feelings while you converse with him? As you are speaking with him, you notice out of the corner of your eye that Jesus has entered the place. Watch him. Watch all his actions and movements. Where does he go? How does he act? What do you think he's feeling? He turns and he's coming towards you and the sick man. What are you feeling now? You step back when you realize that Jesus wants to talk to the sick man. What is Jesus saying to him? What does the man answer? Listen to the whole conversation. Fill in the gospel story for yourself. Dwell specially on Jesus' question, do you want to be made well? Now listen to Jesus' command as he tells the man to get up and walk. A man's first reaction, his attempt to get up, the miracle. Notice the man's reaction. Notice Jesus' reaction. What is yours? Jesus now turns to you. He engages you in conversation. Talk to him about the miracle that's just taken place. Is there any sickness that you are suffering from? Physical, emotional, spiritual? Speak to Jesus about it. Listen to Jesus. Do you want to be made well? Do you really mean what you say when you ask to be healed? Are you ready to take the consequences of a cure? You've now arrived at a moment of grace. Do you have the faith that Jesus can cure you, that he means to cure you? Do you have the trust that this will happen as a result of the faith of the whole group here? Listen to his mighty words as he pronounces the words of healing over you, lays his hands on you. What are you feeling? Are you certain that these words you've heard are going to have an effect on you? In fact, have already had their effect. So you may perceive nothing tangible at the moment. He has given you the healing that only love can give. Now, spend a time in quiet prayer in the company of Jesus. So Ignatius is inviting us to particularly focus on Jesus, but use our imagination and some do it better than others. Don't worry if it doesn't help you, but it might, to just enter the scene and make it your own, and then God will use it to help us pray through that form of prayer. Next meditation we'll do when I come back with you again, if you wish to continue. I'll be actually looking particularly at Teresa of Avila's advice to us in these early stages of prayer, and we'll cover some of the same ground, but from another lovely perspective. But she says, talking about the kind of prayer I've just shared with you from Ignatius, look on Jesus, she says, and reflect. Simple thing to say. But she talks about people, maybe not like you, but certainly like me, in earlier stages, anyway, whatever. These souls, she says, they work almost continually with the intellect, engaged in discursive thought and meditation. That might be where you're at. You maybe never have thought about the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, and you've read a book about it, so you think about it, and your prayer is spent interestingly exploring it. That's good. That's a wonderful way to spend a prayer time. It can be wonderful. So she says, they do well to pray like this, he says, using their mind and thinking about this and that, because nothing further has been given to them. Although it would be good if they engaged for a while in making acts of love, praising God, rejoicing in God's goodness, that he is who he is, and in desiring God's honour and glory. These acts should be made as far as possible, for they are great awakeners of the will. Such souls would be well advised, when the Lord gives them these acts, not to abandon them for the sake of finishing the meditation. So once again, thinking about Jesus, thinking about a scene, though that wasn't primarily what we were doing then, we were doing that, but hopefully there was some undercurrent of something else. But let's say you are thinking about the mysteries of the faith, the creed and the Eucharist and whatever it might be, or Jesus in a particular scene, and your mind is pondering it. That's lovely. But once again, as with spiritual reading or anything else we've talked about tonight, the purpose of the thinking is to engage you in a love communion. So she's just telling us there, if you're in the middle of thinking and exploring and pondering and meditating, in that sense of ruminating, and like a cow going over it, tasting it again and saving it, well then, if your heart is moved, let it be moved, expect it to be moved, and go with it and pray, love, ask for mercy, whatever might come up. She says in another book, The Foundations, not everyone has the kind of imagination that makes meditation possible. You may not be able to. But she says everyone's capable of loving. And progress doesn't lie in thinking much, but in loving much. Here's some really good sound advice that it's not going to affect me, and probably doesn't affect any of you, but it might affect some of you, and it might affect some of your friends. Some people have a lot of prayers they have to get through, because that's the way they've been trained, and well trained, and God bless them, and we're all free. So you can't tell someone else how to love, don't try and tell them how to pray. But it can be, at least I often meet, and you may too, people who are burdened by this. You can be burdened by any method of prayer. And if you've got to get through the rosary each day, and it's kind of like you've got to do it or you're anxious, and you've also got to get through this, and you've got all these prayers for this one and that one and someone else and someone else, and it can become, you can imagine, it can build up into, there's so much to do that you feel you need to do that you can't pray. So here's Catherine of Siena giving this advice. If you look only to the completion of your tally of prayers, Or if you abandon mental prayer for vocal, in other words, stop doing what we just did a moment ago and just say, oh, it's too hard, go back to whatever it happens to be, and not knocking the Hail Mary, but whatever prayers you've got, because they take up your time, then you may set yourself to say a certain number of oral or vocal prayers. But I, says Jesus to Catherine of Siena, and she's just sharing it with us, so I as Jesus, you may set yourself a certain number of prayers you want to say, but I may visit your spirit. Sometimes with a flash of self-knowledge and contrition for your selfishness. Sometimes in the greatness of my love, setting before your mind the presence of the truth in different ways, depending on my pleasure or your longings. Don't abandon my visitation, which you sense with your spirit, to finish up the tally. So you're trying to put your thoughts down on a bit of paper to some significant person in your life. It might be your husband or wife or child. And they enter the room. So you don't talk to them. Well, I don't know if that works. Perhaps that's a good idea. But Jesus is there actually talking to you, and you're not listening or talking with him because you're saying prayers to him. But we do that. We might do it. I hope it's good advice, but I sometimes give it to priests who are a little bit more scrupulous than I am, and saying their office, and so they've got an office to get through, and it's... Say you've got, well, this is my advice for what it's worth, any priests among you. I mean, you set 10 minutes aside for Lourdes in the morning for the beautiful prayer we've just talked about of the liturgy. Say you get halfway through Psalm 63 and you're deeply moved in love. My soul yearns for you, O Lord, and you feel a strong sense of yearning, and you're moved to yearn for the people who are sick in the parish, or you're kind of caught in yearning. And say you stay yearning for 6 minutes, and your 10 minutes is up. Can you see the sense of stopping and saying, I've said Lord's, and not saying, oh, I can't, all this yearning is getting in the road, I've got another two chapters, I've got to get through it. Everything is there for a purpose of prayer. So she put it better than I, but there we are. Now I come in the remaining minutes to move to a third form of prayer, not particularly Ignatian, and I will be doing this with you again, but I wanted to do it tonight too, if I may. We've looked at the prayer of going over the day and reflecting. We've looked at that kind of gospel imaginative entry into Jesus' life and personally being there in the middle of it and being the blind man, being the woman caught in adultery, being the man on the cross, being whoever you are, being everybody in that scene, being the Pharisee, being the poor man down the back. Lord, I am not mercy. So identifying, because there's part of all of those people in all of us. And then now I want to move to what I've called, once again I'll read it because I'll do it more quickly and gently for you. The prayer I'll call it of just being with God. This form of prayer is not something separate or distinct. It finds its place in all periods of formal prayer. We can pray in this way when we pause during spiritual reading, when a particular phrase touches our heart during vocal or liturgical prayer, when we're engaged in our brief daily reflections on our response to God, or we may on occasion feel drawn to spend our time on just one of the sections and leave the others. We can pause and let ourselves be caught up with being with God in the Spirit in any one section. Likewise, when we enter imaginatively into a gospel scene, we may be drawn to just being with the Father or with Jesus. So we stay there. Let's look at that dynamic. First, again, suggested Perhaps method might be a good word. As at the commencement of all extended periods of formal prayer, we settle ourselves comfortably in our chair or on the floor and set out to slow down the tapes playing in our head. By closing our eyes, centering our attention on sensations that are coming to us, sound of insects, birds, rain, wind, traffic, the feel of the breeze on your face, the feel of the support under your body, chair, floor. I'm doing this quickly, but a symbol of God upholding us moment by moment. So we settle our poor body. Secondly, when we feel settled, we move to a passage which we've chosen beforehand to be our lead into prayer. It might be the gospel of the day. A short passage, we can move on to others later, and slowly read the chosen passage a couple of times. We're feeling lowly and abandoned, and we choose the passage, "Come to me, all you who labour and are burdened, and I will give you rest." So we read it over. Note the words that touch us. Take one of them and repeat it over. Relish it. And when we're drawn to do so, make a short prayer to God or to Jesus. "Father, I thank you. Father, what a wonderful Father you are." Or, "Father, I love you." Or, "Lord, have mercy." Or, "Please, let me see again." Whatever it is that's actually moving you. As we make a short prayer, we get in contact with and attend to the feeling in our heart as we utter the prayer. Stay with that feeling until it begins to fade and our mind starts to get going again. So repeat the prayer. This may bring back the feeling and it may cut out the activity of the mind, or it may not. Repeat it slowly till we're drawn to move on somewhere. What underlines this simple method of prayer, which is a mood prayer, almost a one-thought prayer, and it'll vary depending on where you're at, though the one can last a year. What underlies it are the following principles. While the quality of relationship depends on our attitudes of mind, the relationship becomes rooted in and is nourished by the feelings in our heart. Feelings matter, as you don't need me to tell you. Our mind needs to be slowed down if God is to deepen the feelings in our heart and so deepen our relationship with him. This method of prayer deliberately slows down our thinking, which the one I just did with you doesn't. When we leave our prayer in God's hands, as we do in this form of prayer, the Holy Spirit will guide us from one short prayer to another. And when we feel ourselves drawn from one prayer to another, we know in faith that it is the Spirit drawing us and guiding our prayer as he sees best. I want to read for you, I thought it was really quite lovely, a statement made by Anthony Bloom in his book Courage to Pray, and I'll just read it straight through for you. You can either listen or read it with me. He remembered his early years as a priest and some advice that was given to an old woman who came complaining that she'd been saying the Jesus prayer, it was, for many years, but she'd never experienced the presence of God. So this is what he writes. And it may suit you right down to the ground. He said, "I advised her after breakfast to tidy her room, make it as pleasant as possible, and sit down in a position where she could see the whole room, the window into the garden, and the icons with their little oil lamps. When you've sat down," he said, "rest for a quarter of an hour in the presence of God, but don't pray. Be as quiet as you can. And since you obviously can't do nothing, well then knit there in the presence of the Lord and come back and tell me what happens." After a few days, says this man, she came back happily. She'd felt the presence of God. I asked her curiously what had happened, and she said she'd done exactly what I'd suggested. She sat down, she looked about her quietly and peacefully, feeling she had the right to be inactive, the right to not pray for the first time in all these years. And she noticed that the room was peaceful and pleasant. She looked at it and saw it for the first time. There was an encounter between her and the place that she'd lived in for many years without seeing it. Then she became aware of the peace and the silence around her, a peace and silence accentuated by the tick-tick of the clock and the clicking of the needles on the arms of the chair. Gradually, this silence, which had been outside her, came within her and enveloped her. The silence took her out of herself into a richer silence, which was not just the absence of noise, but rich in itself, and at its centre she found a presence. And when she felt this presence, she was moved to pray. But from the depths of this silence, not in a flood of words and a whirl of thoughts, but gently, quietly, taking each word from the silence and offering it to God. Of its own accord, her prayer had become the expression of her inner silence and part of the silence of God, which she had felt. He continues, this is a method easy for everyone to try. It means, of course, contending with the whirl of thoughts and the heart's hesitations, the body's restlessness, the giddiness of the will. There are many exercises based on ascetical practice and psychology, but even without these, simply letting go of ourselves before God in the depths of silence we are capable of will help us to make great progress. There's a little poem I've added there about giving your roots rain, which you might like to read later. Tonight I've taken you as best I can just through the kinds of prayer that we can organise. We're not yet talking about what happens when we've completely surrendered to God and what God can do in our souls, but this is what anyone can do. You might find in all of that helps that suit you where you are now to open your heart to God in prayer. Father, you invite us into communion with you. Tonight, as we seek the guidance of Saint Teresa, and as we ponder some of your psalms, we pray to be sensitive and open to the way in which you wish to be in communion with us. We offer you this prayer through Christ our Lord. Amen. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Well, for those of you who might happen to be new, this is actually the sixth of our lectures or meditations on prayer. We ran through five during Lent, and I'm going to assume that I did those, though if you're starting fresh, it's not going to make a big difference. So in our last meeting, we had built up to this, but we looked at prayer in its early stages. And we were following the guidance of Ignatius of Loyola mainly, but not only he, in the early stages of prayer that people normally go through. Well, tonight I want to go back over that same ground, but now with the guidance of Teresa of Avila. just in the one, this first hour. Looking at what this marvellously saintly woman, who had the remarkable ability of not only praying beautifully, but describing what she does in prayer. So everyone acknowledges her as a wonderful guide. So you might find her that way yourself. So as you ponder that icon there of Jesus and the beloved disciple, I thought it'd be a good way to start. I'll introduce you to this topic, because that's obviously an icon of prayer. Jesus said once to us, what's the point of winning the whole world if you lose your life? And he went on to say, is there really anything that's worth exchanging for life? And you know, he said, I've come that you may live and live to the full. So if life's that important, Teresa of Avila, and everybody else that I know, but she says, you have to make an inner journey. It's not enough to be relating out there, doing this, listening to that, wondering about this. You've got to be there. I've got to be there. I've got to be part of this thing. And if I'm going to be alive, I'll have to find out who I am. And I find out who I am by the love that I receive. And the deepest love will be from God. So I'll need to journey in while I'm journeying out. And as Teresa says, the door to this journey is prayer. Prayer is the door that keeps opening us into this journey to the centre. She says in her interior castle, which I'll talk about in a few minutes' time, she says, since we don't prize ourselves and one another as creatures deserve, since we're made in the image of God, we don't understand the deep secrets that lie within. We don't understand our own secrets, and we don't understand the secrets of others. We never actually get to love. We play with it, but we'll only get to love when we get to commune with each other at depth. And that's actually what prayer is. She says in another place in her spiritual testimonies, I've got all this in your notes there. The thought came to me, she said in one of her prayers, of how a sponge absorbs and is saturated with water. You can perhaps picture the beloved disciple there being saturated with love. It's kind of just coming into him. So she thought of herself as a sponge, and she says, I thought my soul, which was overflowing with the divinity, and in a certain way rejoicing within itself in communion with the three persons of God. So we're talking about that inner journey, and I'm going to be taking you through tonight just the first stages of it as a recapitulation of what we've already looked at. As we go in, we're going to find our feelings, aren't we? And we're going to find our emotions. We're going to find our affections, the way we're affected by life and how we respond to life. We're going to find our motivation. We're going to find why we do things, what we prefer. We're going to find a whole lot of stuff in here, our creative energy, and we're going to find, aren't we, that some of it, the best parts of it, come from our heart. They come from this wonderful place that God is creating moment by moment and breathing into existence, our very being. Some of it's going to well up from the deepest place. But some of these things we're going to discover as we go in are going to be superficial, distracted, ego-protective. They're going to come from those ways we learned to cope at home when we were little children, misunderstood by mum or dad, or partly misunderstood, and we all were and are. Who the heck can understand us? Really, we're all so unique, we don't hardly understand ourselves. So people are going to misunderstand us even if they love us. And we're going to have to learn to cope with that, and we're little. So we discover ways of defending ourselves and getting our way and manipulating parents, and kids are wonderful at that, aren't they? And all this stuff, and it's not all good, but it's, we're just learning it without knowing. And we're going to find all this inside us. But the deepest stuff we're going to find, and we're going to trust this, as we journey in, we've got to go below the surface, all the waves that are crashing on the surface, and we've got to go down to get where the current is. The waves might be bashing from east to west, but the current is actually sweeping us from west to east. We've got to get down into that real still place where we are who we are. And in that mystery of love, which we only discover in prayer, we'll delight in the presence of God. Now, there's nothing so personal as prayer, as you know. There's nothing so demanding as prayer. And no one can tell me how to pray. They can show me. I can watch them pray and think, gee, that's great. I can see the fruit of prayer in their life and all that. But they can't actually teach me how to pray any more than they can teach me how to love. Because I have to learn to pray in my way. And that's it. And no one's ever prayed the way I pray. And I mean everyone in this room. Necessarily. Because God has created us unique. And our prayer is a response to God. How is God treating you? Where is God beckoning you? How can I know? So we can only be helped by general wisdoms, which is what I'll be trying to share with you tonight. Teresa, as I've noted in your notes there, for her prayer is very simple. She says, for example, she says, it's an exercise of love. And may I remind you of that? Thinking about God is no more prayer than thinking about anybody. Thinking is thinking. Prayer is speaking, listening, communing, being with. You might think of someone who's overseas that you love, but you're not actually communicating with them. You're just living with your own lovely thoughts and good. But it's not the same as a phone call or an email, if you're into that. It's not the same as actually sitting there talking. Well, we know that. So prayer is an exercise of love. So let's think about God, yes. Let's ponder. Let's do some spiritual reading. Let's get help and let's wonder about things. But keep remembering that the thinking, the wondering, the pondering, the interest, the logic of thought, even the excitement of it, is not prayer. Prayer is when we actually say thank you, or I love you, or please, or it's actually communing with God. The thoughts might take us there, but that's all they do. She says, it's an intimate sharing between friends. Taking time frequently to be alone with God who we know loves us. Another thing she says in her interior castle is, the soul is a paradise where the Lord finds his delight. That's an enormous act of faith, but I don't know whether you like living with yourself sometimes, but be assured, God really gets a great kick about living with you. God finds your soul a paradise. He walks in the garden with you. Now, if we're not there walking, that's our problem. But he's there, delighting to be with us. Prayer is when we delight to be with him. Again, finally, she says, its center, take place the very secret exchanges between God and the soul. That's a short way, a schematic way of talking now about Teresa of Avila, whom I want to spend the first hour with you with. She lived in the 16th century, castles, men on chargers, troubadours, hacking their way through Andalusia against the Muslims fighting from Aragon to Castile. Everybody wanted to become a knight in shining armour or whatever. That's the world that she lived in Spain in the 16th century. When she imagined the inner journey, she imagined this part, us, you, as a castle. And right in the very centre, in the seventh mansion, in the keep of the castle, the most protected part that no one can really get into, that's where God is. The burning fire and the light is at the very centre of your or my being. This is how she imagines it. It's only an image. And our inner journey, we start outside. We're living outside. We're living out there. We're distracted. But our inner journey is when we decide to enter ourself, to actually go inside. And she divides that into seven stages. We're being drawn by the fire, the warmth. We're being drawn by the light. It's the gravity of grace that's bringing us in, but we have to say yes to it, or no to it, or walk away, or just ignore it. But it's always there drawing us in. So she talks about these seven stages. This evening I'm just going to talk about the outer three. What she calls pre, or what the scholars call pre-contemplative prayer. The early stages of prayer. And the key distinction between the three outer mansions, as she calls them, or dwelling places, or rooms, if you like, the three outer sections of this castle, then there's a tight ring, because something mysterious happens between the third and fourth stages. And what the critical difference that she makes very clear is that in the outer stages, we are still running our prayer. We're still reading books on prayer. We're deciding how we want to pray. We're thinking we'll just go into a quiet place. We're thinking, why don't I use a mantra? We're actually organizing our own prayer, and that's wonderful. It's heroic and it's beautiful, and do it. But there comes a stage, if we're faithful on our journey, where God actually asks us to give the reins to Him, to let go, to fall in love, you might say, to stop our own ego running the show and let God somehow. Now, this is not up to us now. It's a matter of love. But being ready to let go is the best we can do. But if we do let go, we go into contemplative prayer. And I want to talk about that with you in many weeks' time. So there are some introductory principles, though, that I'll talk about before I talk about Therese. Check these by your own thoughts and experience. See how they go with you. But from my reading of Teresa and other places, I would draw out these half dozen basic principles, which I've noted there for you, of prayer. Firstly, the best prayer is the prayer that God gives you. That sounds really simple, but Jove, it's important. Or we might be admiring Catherine of Siena or Francis of Assisi or someone you know or some saint or some person you admire or even your spouse or whoever it could be. Your prayer is your communion with God. Don't admire others, but don't try and copy them. You can't copy anybody's prayer. You've got to have your own love. So the prayer that God gives you, and if it's the simplest prayer, if it's just repeating the Our Father slowly, don't think there's any better prayer. There's no better prayer. Prayer is being with God, however you're with God. Now, if you've got a little child that's two, you treat the child as a two-year-old and you love the child that way, and that's the best way. You don't say, well, it's about time you grew up. Does a two-year-old child just do what you do with two-year-olds, five-year-olds, six-year-olds, 62-year-old immature men? Whoever we are, that's who I am. If you're going to love me, you've got to love me as I am. Now, we can improve under love, but just be who you are. So be who you are. And if you're a thief on a cross or a wandering prodigal son or a Mary of Magdala, well, let Jesus love you where you are. And the best prayer is the prayer that you're invited into by grace. That's the first principle. Don't be envious of any other. Take it. Be grateful for it. Second principle. So is to remember that prayer is only, if you want to measure prayer, I'm not sure that's a good idea, but say you do, if you want to know where you are, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 or 7, well, it's a silly question, so drop it. But the key is by your fruits. That's all this people tell us. Measure prayer by your life, not by prayer. So, if you are praying and you're committed to wanting to be with God, and your life is becoming meaner, more self-centered, more judgmental, more tight, harder to get on with, leaving go your responsibilities in the home just to come here and be in front of the Blessed Sacrament in some kind of ecstasy, ignoring your kids, well, be assured your prayer is hopeless. If your prayer is dry, empty, nothing happening, waste of time, inverted commas, distracted, and you're becoming gentler, humbler, more loving, more thoughtful, more considerate, less ego, your prayer is wonderful. Go for it. Because prayer is communion with God, and the grace will show. The flowers are growing in the garden. They're blossoming. So that's the second principle. The third one is it to know that this is a difficult journey going in. To enjoy communion with God, we have to be determined to journey. We have to be faithful to the journey. We have to stop measuring it. And we have to go in there for God. Teresa says in one of her meditations, many remain at the foot of the mountain who could ascend to the top. Many of us, when the prayer especially gets difficult or boring or kind of pointless, well, there's a lot of things to do. There are grandchildren to look after. There are talks on prayer to prepare. And given a choice between praying and preparing a talk, well, the second one's more practical, isn't it? Look, it's useful and it's loving and it's thoughtful and it's all those things. Oh, I can kid myself all day on this. And so we all find our little ways, probably, of an activity seems to be worthwhile. That's the trap of our modern world. But the truth is that, okay, in my job I can do it, my job, my life I can do it, I can be living for everybody and living superficially really, or giving a lot of love but not all the love God gives me to give. A husband and wife can love each other through the children but don't spend time together, and when the children leave home they look at each other and they think, oh, who's this over a boiled egg at breakfast, because they've forgotten to keep time for each other, perhaps. They love each other, but they're not spending the time to nurture the relationship. We can all do this with the best will in the world. Get busy. So the third principle is don't, for any reason, stop putting time aside for prayer. It's a must. If you don't love God enough to want to be with God, don't, let's kid ourselves, that's all. And it won't always happen, there'll be different days. We're not talking about a rigid program, but I think I've said what I need to say. The fourth principle, I'll read Teresa on this, it follows on. She says, whatever wrong you who practice prayer might do, you mustn't abandon prayer. The same point, I suppose, persevering, but you mustn't abandon it. And she gives another bit of advice in her interior castle. There's no other remedy for the evil of giving up prayer, and I bet you could fill it in yourself, than to start again. So if I've spent 8 years without praying, there's one wonderful thing I can do tonight or tomorrow morning, an absolutely superb thing to do, start praying. There's nothing else. Do it. And God doesn't work in time. So, no, you've got to stay with it, and you can always start again. And instead of spending your time thinking, why don't I pray, spend that time praying. The other principle, I've got two more to go and I'm into it, is that prayer isn't static. We don't, you know this, but let me remind you, you don't start in stage one and then go to stage two, then to stage three, then to stage four, then to stage five. Life isn't like that. Life's full of ups and downs, and all that Teresa is giving us as a wise kind of guide is where in general most of our prayer is most of the time. But you can be at number one and be swept into number seven. God can do anything. You can be in number seven and find that you can't do anything, and the best thing you can do is say the Hail Mary over slowly, like Teresa of Lisieux did or anybody else. You can. Prayer is the prayer you're given and prayer you have. And it's not a rigid ladder that we're climbing. It's a kind of a maturing in love. And as all of you know, sometimes love has to go back and start again. Sometimes you're whatever. We're up and down. Our feelings are different. Our situations are different. We go through phases psychologically and physically and mentally. And let's just spend time with God as best we may. But there are, as I'll show you tonight again, there are general, automatic, almost natural progressions that happen, at least in the first three stages, which we're talking about tonight, that you can expect to happen in your own life, and maybe you'll recognise them as soon as I share them with you. And the last point is, I'll quote Teresa again, she says, "As much as I desire to speak clearly about these matters of prayer, they'll be very obscure if you haven't experienced it." So she's saying the obvious thing, like as in every field, we can only recognise what we already know. But that's good, because you know the experience, I certainly do, of sometimes you're thinking something, but it's thing, and then someone puts a word on it. And you say, ah, that's it. And it just helps a lot. You read a poem that says what you want to say, or just someone finds the word for you, or the statement, or the to say where you are, because we just don't quite know how to put a word on it. Well, when we read a Teresa or the others, we can see, oh, that's what's happening. And we don't feel quite as alone or lost or bewildered, because someone's already marked out the track for us a bit. So let's begin looking at Teresa's advice for us as we begin prayer. So for the moment, I'll just imagine that all of us have never prayed before, really. Or we haven't prayed for 30 years. It's unlikely, or you'd hardly be here tonight. But just imagine it. It doesn't hurt to think you're just starting. Because most of us, you know, you might say, if you thought you were just starting to learn how to love, I think that would make you a pretty good lover. Because the more you know of it, the more you realise you are only just starting. So let's, for the moment, imagine ourselves. We're outside in the bush, and we dronk-de-dronk-de-dronk-de-dronk. We gallop over the, what do you call that thing? And going into the castle. The bridge over the moat. And then there's this dirty big thing they lift up, I can't remember the name of it. Portcullis. And we enter here. You dare the inner journey. Let's get her advice of what to do at the beginning. So Teresa describes people at this stage. It might fit you, it might fit me. She said, these people, they've got good desires, and once in a while they entrust themselves to the Lord and reflect on who they are, but in a hurried way. They're actually dashing down to the, what's the place where you put bets on horses called? Tab. I think I'd know, but I just forgot. So they're dashing down to the tab, and on the way they think, oh, thank you God for a beautiful day. So it's okay, it's good. It's a passing little thought. Or they're getting out of bed in the morning and they kind of bang their thing and they swear and then they say to God, I'm sorry. A little passing, little hurried thought. And that's the best we can do, and off they go. That's the kind of person we're talking about. So the light, these are my words, but her ideas, the light coming from God is right there in the centre, and by the time you get out here, it's not so warm, it's just a bit of a light, glimmer. And there's a bit of warmth coming from the fire in the seventh mansion, and there's a bit of gravity pulling me in too, but I'm just there. And it's pretty dim, and I rarely pay attention to God, but I do sometimes. And sometimes you respond and on the run. But I'm still living a pretty distracted life. And spiritually, she says, you're still pretty anemic. So if you feel you're there, when I finish this page, you can go home. You've got all the advice you need. No, please stay. This is her advice to us. Be resolute in striving not to sin. What a beautiful resolution to make. Don't muck around with sin, she says. Learn to hate it. Turn your... And she's talking about serious... Resolve to change my life. And if I'm mucking around here or distracted there or interfering here or playing games or whatever might be going on, stop it. Don't want to stop it, just stop them. Be resolute in wanting not to sin. Because sin's a horrible thing and it's messy and it certainly mucks up our journey. Secondly, if you want to really get into prayer, she says, detach yourself from whatever's cluttering up your life and holding you back. We'll look at this more later. Don't you decide what to let go. If we start on this ascetical journey of cutting this off and cutting that off and deciding not to do this, our ego may be actually getting worse if we're the ones that think we've got the wisdom of what to do. Now, listen to the call and let go whatever's stopping you. Let God tell you what to let go. Listen in prayer deeply and respond faithfully to it. I think that's the way to go. That asceticism is... my images of Peter when he's in the boat, you know, and you're supposed to be in the boat. You're on the lake, for heaven's sake. Why wouldn't you be in a boat? Stay in the boat. But then Jesus is walking on the water. And Pete doesn't say, oh, I better get out of the boat so I can get to Jesus. He says to Jesus, hey, if you call me, I'll come to you across the water. What a difference. Waiting for the call, wanting to go to Jesus. He doesn't want to get out of the boat. He wants to go to Jesus. And he also knows he'd be silly to do it on his own. He wants Jesus to come. Jesus, come on, okay, come. Well, then whatever you need to let go, let go. Because love is calling you to let it go, not your own ego wanting to be a passionate ascetic with a mirror attached. Third piece of advice she gives us, if we're going to get in the right place and gallop into the right place, is be vigilant in loving others. That's a very... Love one another as I have loved you. We'll never go wrong loving others, caring for them, being thoughtful, being not self-focused or self-contained, but responding to the needs. That's a good, safe, human, real way of checking our prayer. And lastly, her advice to us, just beginning, is keep your eyes on Jesus. Beautiful advice. Set your eyes on Christ, she says, and on his saints. Don't be looking at yourself all the time. Look out. Let him invite you. Do what Peter did and watch Jesus on the water. As soon as he took his eyes off Jesus and looked to the water, he started to sink. Keep your eyes on him. Watch him. And he will invite you and take you in this inner journey. Now, her advice for those of us we have started to pray, and we're taking prayer quite seriously, and we're forming a habit of praying. We're still doing the praying, and we're still deciding when to do it, and we haven't fallen in love yet in a real faith sense, but we're genuine, and we're acquiring a habit of prayer. What advice does she give us on this, what she calls the second level of prayer? Teresa's speaking here of those who are committed to prayer, and you may recognise yourself here. Perhaps they're beginning to be sensitive to God's word coming to them in the events of life, and they reflect on their life in a prayerful way. They hear sermons and they're moved by what they hear, perhaps. So they're echoing and their heart's a bit in touch and they're thirsty and hungry and so on. They share their spiritual experiences with a friend or... And through spiritual reading, which they enjoy, they're not always reading yellowbacks, they actually like reading something from the mystics or reading the scriptures or something like that. And then in the joys and trials of life, they find themselves praying. There'd be millions of people in this state, probably all of us. Well, at this time, this is the kind of advice Teresa gives in her writings to those of us here. People are still not avoiding occasions of sin and they find themselves basically living a good life but often slipping back. They can't go to tennis without talking about their neighbours behind their back. Or golf. Or have a beer. Or sit around a presbytery table. Or wherever you happen to be. And they find themselves putting people down and they think, oh God, what did I say that for? But they did. We did. Or they find themselves... whatever it be, they fall slip back into habits of sin. It's important, says Teresa, that we try to live virtuous lives in obedience to God's will. And we spent a whole evening on obedience earlier. As revealed through the ordinary means of God's providence. Become sensitive to what's happening around us. Become listening, attentive people with a heart that's a bit awake. And looking for what, asking what God might want, not too caught up in ourselves. We must be genuine, she says, in wanting to resist temptations to sin. We must be fair dinkum about it and not play with it or excuse ourselves. Or... And she advises us in this state of prayer, if we want to be drawn into the half in the centre, and this is such good advice, isn't it? Don't go to prayer looking for consolation. Don't go to prayer to feel good. It's an understandable feeling, but be wary of it, she says. It's like a person who loves the feeling of being in love. But you're supposed to love the person that you're loving. And if I'm too caught up in the... And it's natural to do it, I suppose. How it feels nice loving. And if that's what I love for, oh, you can see as well as I that that's actually not love. It's not entirely bad, but it's not love. And if a mother loves a daughter for herself because she wants the daughter to be there with her, natural stuff. And if she keeps the daughter there and doesn't let the daughter meet this person or go out and... Well, you can see what's happening, can't you? She's keeping the daughter there for her old age or whatever. I don't want to go too much into this. It might be hurtful. But that can happen, as you well know. But for a mother to actually want to see the daughter spread wings and fly must be very fearful and terrible. I imagine it's very hard. But it's hard for all of us to love people and let them go. It's hard for a spouse to really do that. Envy, jealousy, all these other little feelings come in. But to actually want the other person to be free enough to go, but enjoy the fact that they stay, that's love, I presume. And that's what it seems to me to be. It's the freedom of the other person. But if I hook you so that you've almost got to love me, then actually something's going wrong, isn't it? So if we do it with God too, if we go into prayer so I'll feel good, no, we go to prayer because God is God and we want to be with God. The feeling good may happen as a fruit, but not as a condition and a reason and a motivation. Go to prayer just because God is God. And that means embracing the cross. Teresa doesn't say this, to my knowledge, but let me say it and you check it by your own. It makes no sense to me anyhow. I don't think following Jesus brings more cross. I can't see that. Well, anyhow, it doesn't make any sense to me. Everyone's life has got a fair bit of the suffering in it. What happens, I presume, when we follow Jesus is that we get in touch with our cross. We get in touch with the suffering. We depth it. We stay with it. We don't hide it, repress it, run away from it and ignore it. It's still there, the suffering that comes to all of us in life. But we can callous over and not be in touch with it. But if we're with Jesus, he was open to the suffering that was there. So he actually lived it, absorbed it, tasted it, embraced it, and loved through it. And I guess that's all any of us can do is grow through the suffering that we have and become more loving and more gentle and more prayerful. Or we can become bitter and pretend and I suppose half of spend our time running away. No one wants to suffer. Well, she says, no, you've got to learn to take your life as it is and embrace it all. Because embracing life, you're embracing God and embracing yourself and your past. And her last advice, I think I put this here because it suited me, don't be too self-reliant. I have to tell myself that, you see. Some of us tend to be that. Don't be too self-reliant. We're to listen to Jesus reminding us that we've got to become like a little child, he said, and recognize our dependence on God and relying on God's grace. Insofar as I or you become self-reliant, it's not a bad thing. It's part of ego. It's part of maturing, I guess, in some ways. But we've really eventually got to let that go. Because who are we? There's a much bigger life there calling me from the mystery of the infinite God. And to rely on God is so much more beautiful and sensible and productive and everything than to rely on this little feeble creature. Here's some advice from Teresa, from her own writings, to those of us who are in practice of meditating and perhaps spending time in prayer pretty regularly, you know, in the second stage. And she talks about one of the problems that happens here to many of us. Depends on your temperament, but it might suit you. She talks about people who work almost continually with their intellect, finding things out, putting things together, working things out, planning, and that kind of thing. That's me, but it mightn't be you. We've all got different temperaments. And we engage in discursive thought and meditation. They do well, she says, people who spend their prayer time doing this. Reading, discovering, interested, pondering, meditating, reflecting. They do well because nothing further has been given to them. Although it would be good if they engaged for a while in making acts of love, praising God, rejoicing in God's goodness, that he is who he is and desiring God's honour and glory. These acts should be made as far as possible for they're great awakeners of the will. Such souls would be well advised when the Lord gives them these affections, these acts, not to abandon them for the sake of finishing the meditation. So you might be reading something spiritual that helps you, and you are moved in a moment by something to thank God. Well, her advice is stay there, stay there. Stay thanking God. Don't rush to the next sentence. Don't let that go, because that's the prayer. The thanks is the prayer. The rest is preparation for the prayer. So don't get too caught up here, is her advice to us. He has this other good advice in her life from her own experience. This is what she's so good at. It may suit you. She said she got to a stage where she couldn't think. I couldn't reflect discursively with the intellect, so I strove to picture Christ with me. And it did me greater good, she said. In my opinion, to picture him in those scenes where I saw him more alone. It seemed to me that being alone and afflicted and he was in need, then he had to accept me. I had many simple thoughts like this. The scene of his prayer in the garden especially was a comfort to me. I strove to be his companion there. If I could, I thought of the sweat and agony he had undergone in that place. I desired to wipe away the sweat he so painfully experienced. But I recall that I never dared to actually do it, since my sins appeared to me so serious. I remained with him as long as my thoughts allowed me to, for there were many distractions that tormented me. So she learnt what we did earlier with Ignatius, and it may not work for you. Depends on your temperament, imagination, a lot of things. But it might. She learnt, rather than thinking about wonderful things, to look at Jesus in the scenes of the gospel. And you can be the blind man, and you can be the leper, and you can be the woman at the well, as I'm sure you know. Be that person, and perhaps imagine the scene if you can. I'm not much good at this, but somebody, I know people who are, and you might be. So just imagine the scene and be there in the scene and enter it. And when Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? You be the you and reply. That's prayer. She found that helpful. In her Way of Perfection, she writes, if you're experiencing trials or you're sad, look at him on the way to the garden, what great affliction he bore in his soul. Having become suffering itself, he tells us about it and he complains of it. My soul is sorrowful even unto death. Stay here and watch with me. Or behold him bound to the column, filled with pain, with all his flesh torn in pieces by the great love that he bears you. So much suffering. Persecuted by some, spat on by others, denied by his friends, abandoned by them, and no one to defend him. Frozen from the cold, left so alone that you can console each other. Or behold him burdened with the cross, for they didn't even let him take a breath. He look at you with those eyes so beautiful and compassionate, filled with tears. He'll forget his sorrows to console you in yours, merely because you yourselves go to him to be consoled and you turn your head to look at him. Now let's go to the third stage of prayer. Here Teresa is talking about people like this. She describes it in her interior castle. They long not to offend God. They even guard themselves against venial sin. And when they sin venially, they notice it and they pull back from it. So they're really quite sensitive, conscientious, morally good. They're fond of doing penance and setting aside periods for recollection. They spend their time well in carrying out works of love to their neighbour, she says. There's no reason why entrance into the final dwelling place should be denied these souls, nor will the Lord deny them this entrance if they desire it. For such a desire is an excellent way to prepare oneself so that every favour may be granted. Well, for people like that, Teresa offers what she calls a simple prayer of awareness. Now, it's once I explain it, and if you need to explain it, it's really very simple, and it's very natural. It's like friendship. If you meet someone and you kind of like them, and then you have a chat and you realise you share interests with this person, you share and you like their thoughts and the way they feel about things and the way they relate to their brothers and sisters and whatever, or friends. And so a friendship starts, and on the second time you meet them, you say to them, oh, g'day, like, it was nice to meet you. What do you do with yourself? And they tell you, and you chat for about an hour because you're exchanging information. Can you imagine what it would be like if you met them a week later? You went up to this person and the person said, oh, g'day, what do you do with yourself? well, you tell them again. By the time they did it the fifth time, going over this, you'd be wondering whether they're listening, wouldn't you? The conversation is kind of getting a bit circular, so the next time you put the answering machine on, and then you vet the call because it's boring and it's actually you've misunderstood what's going on. We can go to God and treat God like that. Blah, 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 blah. It's natural, surely, to come into a stage where we don't have to think a lot about this or say a lot about it. We just get simpler. And all you need to think of is you in me and me in you. And you don't have to go through the John chapter 15 and think of the Trinity. And I mean, they're all good things to do. But the very words, the mantra, holds it, and it's all there. And you just enter into communion with God. That's as you do with a friend. You can just sit there quietly fishing or just looking at the sunset or holding hands or in love or whatever. And there's silence, because you know what the silence means. It's already been said. The silence has been created by the earlier words. It's just simpler. Well, that happens in prayer. You could say automatically happens in prayer if you let it happen. And it's a natural movement. And that's the prayer she offers us to think about. And that's the most lovely prayer we can have. And that's as far as we can go till we actually hand over the reins to God. In her way of perfection, she writes, "I'm not asking you now that you think about him, or that you draw a lot of concepts, or make long and subtle reflections with your intellect. I'm not asking you to do anything more than look at him. Who can keep you from turning the eyes of your soul towards the Lord? In the measure you desire him, you will find him. God never takes his eyes off you." And when you look, the look says it all. And you don't need to repeat, perhaps. And that could be any mood at all. It could be sorrow, it could be thanksgiving, it could be wonder, it could be delight, it could be adoration, it could be regret, it could be pain, it could be why have you abandoned me. It could be any real mood, because we've got to be real when we're with God. And that's the only way to be. And God knows how we are anyhow. So the mask has to fall away. And just be there, crying, laughing, joyful, miserable, whatever. Just be there in his presence. "It's well," she says, "in her life to reflect for a time, yes. But we must sometimes remain by his side with our minds hushed in silence. If we can, we should occupy ourselves with looking upon him who is looking at us. Keep him company, talk with him, pray to him, humble yourself, delight in him." And she also says, "You need never withdraw from this loving communion. Go within yourselves even during your ordinary occupations. If you can recall the companionship which you have within your soul for as much as a moment, it will help you greatly." Because if you can learn to be silent, and it's hard, but once you've learned it, you can be silent anywhere then, and you're at home with yourself, so you don't need whatever. It's a great gift. But in that silence, we were also trained. You know, we'd have our prayer in the morning, whatever it was. I don't know what's going on in my little head. But you'd have a little aspiration or something you're trained. So during the day, as you chopped out the trees or whatever you were doing, fixed up the vegetable garden or did something, you could be saying, "I am the vine, you're the branches," or something, or "God, I love you," or thinking of the blessed you, of the little light in front of the tabernacle, and just saying a little word over, and just saying it over. It was good training, so that it becomes part of your breathing. So when you pray in the morning, and you might have a very simple prayer, and you might be something like, "Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid, I am with you." And that might be where you are. And that's what the prayer holds. Well, at the end of the prayer, you remember that little phrase, "Do not be afraid, I am with you." So you walk down and you're waiting for the bus and, "Do not be afraid, I am with you." And you do something else and, do not be afraid. You know what I'm saying, don't you? So the mood of the day is picked up from the prayer and takes you into the next prayer. So you're actually living in prayer, really. You're living in communion with God in a simple way, thinking about other things, doing all you have to do, but it's there. It's perhaps like a mother who's thinking of her baby who's asleep and she's doing a million other things, but the baby's so close because the slightest little movement and mum's in there because she's attached while conscious of everything else. So maybe it's something. It may not be easy to recollect oneself in this way, and it will require discipline and persistence. However, it is important to remember, I think this is wonderful advice of Teresa, don't force it. It must come gently. If I was allowed to give one bit of advice after 38 years of priesthood, can I give one bit of advice after 38 years of priesthood? It would be gentle with yourself. Nearly everybody I know is too hard on themselves, too conscious of their sinfulness. And that means they're too self-centered, really. It's understandable, it's forgivable, it's lovable, but it's be gentle, be your own big sister or your own big brother, and realise this poor little bloke or girl inside you, heavens, you were pushed out of the womb without being asked, somebody snapped the bloody, excuse the expression, the umbilical cord, and someone else sent you off to primary school at 4 and a half, and a nun came out with some boiling hot milk and poured it down your throat so that Michael would get fat. Or something. People told you what to do and put you in places that didn't understand you and didn't understand your temperament, and your father wanted you to win the Olympic Games and you had your mother's body, more or less. And you know what I mean? Like, all this has happened to our life. We've been pushed around by experts all our life. Well, this poor little bloke or poor little woman that you are, give her a break. So be gentle with yourself. And that doesn't mean soft. It means let it come gently and don't work at prayer. When people say to me, all right, I'll try, I say, don't try, just do it. Try means, you know. And there's often an excuse for not doing things, by the way, trying. Just do it. Now, mate, I guess it's not as simple as that, but I think there is a big difference between doing something and trying to do it. Be gentle. As soon as the soul finds itself alone, it should seek Jesus and converse with him. And Teresa suggests an icon might help you, or an image. Now, there are some people whose brains have been butchered by hideous teachers who've read the book of Leviticus that says you can't have images of God, and they're still around, these people. It just drives me crazy. So therefore you can't have a picture of Mary, or you can have a picture of your girlfriend or boyfriend, but you can't have a picture of Our Lady. It's bizarre. Or you can't have an icon of Jesus, you know, because you're not allowed to have images, graven images, and forget it all, for heaven's sake. Yes, in the Jewish world, where people had all these bulls and things, which were misunderstood by the Jews, by the way, they didn't think they were gods, the other people had, God was the invisible presence on them. But anyway, with all this misunderstanding, they said, we're not going to have an image of God. Okay, don't let's have an image of God, but we can have Jesus, Mary, we can. Yeah, it's obvious. So here's this beautiful Teresa saying, look, you might find it helpful if you get an image or a picture of the Lord. One that you like the one I put up there earlier. Maybe it helps you. I've just come back from a week in Tarawara Monastery or Abbey, giving a retreat to the Cistercians there, and I didn't do it on John's Gospel particularly, it was on monasticism and so on. But I used that image because I'd used it here with you people last year and used it every now and then. And it was interesting how it all grew on them, because it's visual and it's about communion, it's about prayer. And at the end, they're all writing to Jerusalem to get a copy because it's the only place I know it exists. Well, if someone objects to that, you feel like loving them into some kind of common sense. I do. But there it is anyhow. So she advises, she says, may help you. She says, don't wear it round your neck where you can't see it. But use it regularly when you talk and he'll tell you what to say. Just a simple, sensible woman. So with that, I conclude, what I've tried to do with you today, this evening, is Teresa's guiding us through what happens when we begin to pray, what we'll call pre-contemplative prayer, the prayer that we do, the prayer that we commit ourselves to, the prayer that we find ourselves while we're doing the prayer, as it were, under God's grace and in response to love, but we're still, as it were, holding the reins. This is what normally happens to people. You might find that it rings bells with you. Later, a good deal later, I'll look with you at what advice Teresa will give you as to what God might do in your soul once you let go your ego and hand over to God. And she's a beautiful guide as to what God did with her. And a lot of people have found that it's true of them. And sometimes if God is taking you into prayer, it's nice to have someone you think, oh, is that what's happening? And we'll do that later.